Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. All right, I want to tell you about one of the dumbest things that I've probably ever seen happen personally when it comes to performance training. It's not necessarily dangerous or unethical, just dumb in a way that, you know, we kind of look at things and be like, I can't believe I didn't think of this. Now, we focus so much on having great training programs and trying to be very methodical about how we give athletes and people their training programs in terms of the sets and the reps and the volume and how things are organized and laid out, yada, yada. That's what most people really focus on. But one of the biggest issues that I personally see, especially working with young athletes, isn't necessarily the training program portion of it, what we do, and then realizing the kids might not be making progress, but it comes down to talking to them about hydration. All right. Many people are very lazy when it comes to the hydration side of their performance or their weight loss or their goal setting in terms of their physical performance. Okay. I can't really explain it any simpler than that, because we'll have people focus on what pre-workout I should take or what supplement I should take, or you know, what kind of special dietary approach I should be doing, or a certain kind of programming model, and they're not drinking enough water, they're not getting enough salt, right? They're not getting enough electrolytes. And these are things that immediately help performance, can help you eke out more from what you're currently doing without having to try to chase any kind of special thing. So something that I've realized working with people as long as I have is that hydration is a very simple question thing that we can address that we typically tend to like pass up on or dismiss or not even think about being a base level thing. So today I want to talk about this in terms of being one of probably the most boring things that you can talk about when it comes to improving athletic performance. But I also believe it's one of the most important things and one of the most slept on things. So welcome back to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. I'm genuinely glad you're here. If you are a returning supporter, I always appreciate you tuning in for today's episode. If you happen to be new, I really appreciate you tuning in. I hope you take away one awesome thing from today's episode to be able to help you, whether that be with your own training, with your clients, with your athletes, or overall just to educate yourself in terms of the field of athletic performance, strength and conditioning, what have you. So a quick note before we start, because I do think it is kind of ironic, but we are going to name this topic what it is after hydration. And I am aware that my gym being Thirst and the Thirst for More podcast, doing an episode on hydration, it almost writes itself, right? It's kind of a joke that I already realized as I kind of sat down and planned everything out. But I mean, I'm going to move on. So you can take that for today's little delight and go on from there. So here is what today is actually going to be about, right? This is not going to be a hydration is important episode. I'm not going to try to cram that down your throat. You already know that hydration is important, at least you should. That's not the information that I really want to try to display here. If I spent an hour on an episode telling you to drink more water, I would be wasting basically everybody's time. So what I want to do today is something a little bit more challenging and more useful. I want to walk you through the research side of hydration, and also including the parts where I think research kind of goes back and forth on things. And then I also want to hand you something that you can use to be able, either from like a bathroom scale or be able to measure things and actually notice some difference in terms of your hydration and things that you can use for your athletes and your clients. Because here's the thing that personally drives me crazy about this topic is that hydration is in this weird dead zone of the athletic performance, strength and conditioning field. And it's simultaneously the thing that everybody agrees is incredibly important. And it's also the thing that nobody in terms of a strength and conditioning facility, a private gym like my own, a high school weight room, it's something that nobody's actually measuring or really truly paying attention to, right? We might look at bar speed and sets and reps and things like that, as I mentioned earlier in the episode, but we don't know if our athletes are losing weight or even maintaining their weight when it comes to their practice or their strength and conditioning sessions. And I think that's a real gap that we have in our own field. And I think it's something that we can actually fix for a very cheap amount of money and a little bit of time. And so here's where we're going to go. First, we're going to talk about why this topic always gets dismissed, because it does, and there is a real reason for it. And the reason is more interesting than what we would actually think to believe, that there was a science war in the 2000s, and we're still living in between what those are saying. And then secondly, the physiology side. What is actually happening in the body when an athlete is down maybe 1, 2, 3% of their hydration, right? Not necessarily the way that they're feeling, but the mechanisms. I'm going to go into a little bit of things about plasma volume, the stroke volume, thermoregulation, right? Central nervous system aspect of things, and the recovery piece that usually is what's getting dismissed whenever we talk about this. And then third, as always, I'm going to try to bring some of the research and evidence side home on this. I'm going to be honest with you here in a way that's going to make the episode less clickable. Okay, I'm not really after clicks. I'm after trying to inform people, because the evidence can be kind of wishy-washy depending on what you're looking at. And there are meta-analyses that say dehydration wrecks performance, right? And then there are also meta-analyses that say that the effect largely disappears when you let people actually pace themselves on their own training. Both are actually real, right? And we'll talk about those a little bit more in depth. And then the fourth thing, we're talking about the myths, right? There's four really big ones I'm going to try to cover. And then one of them is actually going to make some of us a little bit frustrated, because it's going to be in regards to cramping. And fifth is then going to be the system, right? The protocol that you can take away from this, be able to measure how much you're sweating out and losing weight, monitoring things, and the before and after training session ideas that you can have, how much sodium, when you should be able to take this, how to run this with a team or a group of athletes or a group of people if you happen to be in that space as well. And then we'll actually close talking a little bit more about the special population side, because youth athletes, weight class athletes, older masters athletes, are not just smaller or older versions, right? There are going to be some different things going on. So we'll talk a little bit more on that as well. All right. So the first thing I want to talk about is, why does nobody take hydration seriously, like truly seriously? And to understand that, we have to understand the hydration science in sport did not really develop in like the small vacuum in a laboratory, right? It developed pretty much in a marketing budget, if we want to be real. So for roughly three decades, the dominant message to athletes was that thirst is a lagging indicator. By the time you're thirsty, it's too late. Drink aggressively and drink early. And that message came packaged with a product, and a very large share of the foundational research on exercise hydration was funded by companies that sold that product. Now, I want to be careful here, because this is where people get really sloppy, is that the industry funding does not automatically make research wrong. Okay, that's not always the case. Just obviously there's people that are clearly invested in it, and we have to be honest about that. But some of the best thermoregulation work ever done came out of institutes with commercial backing, and the researchers involved were and are serious scientists, right? There's no doubt about that either. But if your entire critique of a study is who paid for it, then we don't have a critique, right? We just basically have a personal opinion about how we kind of feel about something. But funding does shape what questions can get asked here. And the question that got asked for 30 years is, what happens when we take fluid away from an athlete? It almost never was, what happens when we give an athlete too much hydration? And so that's just what happens when the people paying for the research have a product that solves one to two of these problems and not the other. So you get a very well-characterized answer to half of the question at the end of the day. And the message that gets filtered down to coaches was even more blunter than the research, obviously. The research said something like, avoid substantial fluid deficits during prolonged exercise in the heat. And what got to the high school football field was, drink as much as you possibly can all the time. And if you're thirsty, you've already actually failed because you're dehydrated. Every layer of translation between a journal and what's going out on the field strips out what's actually truly important and what we were trying to take away from this research and how we can actually apply that. And so then we had this pendulum swing, and it swung hard to the other side. Starting in the late 90s, accelerating through the 2000s, a group of researchers, most prominently Tim Noakes and the colleagues, started publishing on exercise-associated hyponatremia. So athletes were not dying of dehydration in marathons. Some of them were dying from over-drinking, diluting their blood sodium to the point of cerebral edema. And then there was a second wave of criticism landed, which was that methodical rather than clinical portion of it was that researchers pointed out that most of the studies showing dehydration destroys performance use a specific kind of protocol. You put someone on a bike, you fix the workload, and then you tell them to hold that workload until they can't do it anymore. Now that's going to give you the time to exhaustion. The problem is that no sport works in that actual way, right? In real competition, athletes self-select their own intensity, their own pace. And when you run the same dehydration protocol using a time trial where the athlete chooses the effort, the effect is much, much smaller whenever we actually go to look down a little bit more deeper into things. And so here's where we happen to be today. And this is my actual thesis here for today's episode, was that the correction was justified, just the overcorrection was not necessarily justified. Because what a lot of coaches heard was not necessarily the nuanced version of things. What they heard was hydration was oversold, thirst is fine, stop worrying about it. And a message that was developed by studying endurance athletes pacing themselves over hours got basically quietly applied to a completely different population. So chances are your athletes and my athletes are not running a self-paced marathon, right? Our athletes are showing up to the weight room, the strength and conditioning sessions, and being told exactly what to lift, how many reps they should be doing, maybe you're even doing on a clock, right? Something that's somewhat controlled there. And then that this is a fixed intensity environment for the most part, right? Right. That is the exact condition where the dehydration effect is the largest. Now, the critique of hydration research came from a self-paced world. In the marathon world, most of what we do to athletes is not necessarily going to be self-paced. So both camps are right, and both camps are talking basically through each other as well. And the coaches in the middle got left with nothing that they can do or actually put into the applicable side of what we do in terms of working with athletes, whether it be on the field or in the weight room. And so that's what my goal here today with this episode is, try to be able to bridge that gap of all that noise that I kind of just threw at your face and actually make this a little bit more methodical. So let's build this from the ground up here really quick. I'm going to take a drink before we dive any further. Because if you understand the mechanism that you do not have to memorize the recommendations, okay, so we can just derive to these. And mechanism number one is plasma volume in the cardiovascular aspect. So when you sweat, you're not pulling fluid evenly out of a big undifferentiated tank, right? A meaningful share of that loss comes out of plasma. And plasma is the liquid portion of our blood. So less plasma means less blood volume. Less blood volume means less blood returning to the heart between the beats. Less return means less blood pumped out per beat. And then that is going to be that your stroke volume is actually going to go down. But your muscles are still going to need the same oxygen delivery to do the same work. So the only thing left the body has left to manipulate to be able to do that is then going to be the rate. Right? So your heart rate is then going to increase. And this is why a dehydrated athlete has a higher heart rate than, you know, and the exact same output. Okay. They basically just pull a lever to be able to make an adjustment for dehydration. Now their heart is not working harder because they're necessarily, you know, more unfit, obviously. It's working harder because each beat is moving less actual volume out whenever they do that. So when the volume is going down, we're going to increase that to be able to meet the demands of whatever the athlete happens to be doing, whether it be in the weight room or practice. And this is the first practical thing that I want you to take away, that if you use heart rate for anything like conditioning zones, work to rest ratios, readiness, return to play, hydration status could be a silent variable inside of every single one of those numbers. So if you happen to find an athlete that's having issues with this, or maybe it's showing that they're quote-unquote detrained or they're seeing negative performance results, it could be because they're down a couple pounds and because of the hydration side of things, right? Again, this is something that's sneaking up that many people are not really thinking a lot of. All right, mechanism number two is going to be thermoregulation. So your primary cooling system in the heat is evaporative. So sweat is going to get on the skin, obviously. It evaporates, and it takes heat with it. And to do that, you have to move blood to the skin to be able to get that out there. Now, think about what we just established, we just talked about. The blood volume is already decreased at this point. And now you're asking that reduced volume to do two things at one time. We're trying to deliver oxygen to the working muscles and tissues that we have and carry heat to the skin at the same time. So something is going to have to give in that relationship. Usually it is both. A little bit is actually seeing a decrease, right? skin blood flow gets throttled or decreased and not as optimal. So the core temperature is going to climb even faster there, and muscle blood flow gets throttled. So the performance is then also going to drop. And this is the piece that turns performance conversation into the safety aspect when we come to hydration. Because dehydration does not just make an athlete slower in the heat, it makes an athlete less able to shed the heat, which means that they climb toward a dangerous core temperature faster than a hydrated athlete doing the identical training session. And this is why heat acclimatization protocols and hydration protocols are not two separate policies. They are usually one separate policy that you have, right? Learning to acclimate yourself to the heat, but also be hydrated, do the right things, get enough water, right? That's how this all works when it comes to the performance side of things. All right, third mechanism is then also going to be the central nervous system. And this is the one I think is the most underrated when it comes to our field. So brain tissue is mostly water, and the brain is extremely sensitive to changes in osmolality of the fluid around it, all right? Headaches, anytime your head bothers you, or concussions, right? We talk a lot about that when it comes to the brain and the head. And mild hypohydration has been associated with degraded attention, degraded executive function, elevated perception of effort, and a decrease in mood, or basically having a worse mood of things. So if we sit with perception of effort for a second here, you have the same load, the same sets, it's going to feel heavier. If you run any kind of autoregulation-based training program, so RPE, RIR, right, velocity targets with a subjective override, you are building your entire day on top of a perceptual system that dehydration degrades. The athlete underloads themselves, and neither of us happens to know why we're doing that, all right? And then think about our skill athletes. Reaction time, decision-making, pattern recognition underneath fatigue. That's what we talk about when we talk about being able to be mentally sharp at the end of games or end of competition, making smart decisions. That's the last set of the technically demanding lift as well, being able to think and mentally dig deep, right? It's going to start to affect some of that stuff. And that is when we take a football player, for example, we talk about our lineman or linebacker or whatever, they happen to be down 3 or 4% of their hydration, right? They stop figuring out not only from an effort perspective of being able to put that forth, but the mental side of being able to read defenses or offenses and be able to make better decisions is also going to be something that happens as well. And I mean, you could take the same thing with basketball. I'm using football because they're usually outside in the heat a little bit more, but you get the idea. All right. The mechanism that limits our ability to fix things is going to be absorption. So before we actually move on from the physiology side, I want to add one more thing that doesn't usually get covered in terms of hydration, because it explains why the obvious solution does not work. The drinking fluid and absorbing fluid are two completely different events in the body. So what you drink sits in the stomach until it empties into the small intestines, and almost all absorption is going to happen there in the small absorption or in the small intestine side of things. Gastric emptying is not a fixed rate, right? It slows down as exercise intensity climbs above roughly 70% of maximum effort. Okay, just an estimate here. And it slows down with high carbohydrate concentration in the drink as well. So it slows down when the athlete is already dehydrated, and which is, you know, obviously the tough part, because the athlete who needs to absorb fluid is the athlete least able to do so, right? So what's going to speed this up is keeping a moderate volume in the stomach rather than letting it empty completely. So basically think about sipping and keeping the drink from being too concentrated when we talk about sugar and carbohydrates. From practicality side, this is why chugging water or chugging a drink does not work. Right, an athlete who realizes at minute 40 of their practice that they're behind and then drinks a 20 ounce just to go all down in one time, right, does not become hydrated immediately afterwards. They become an athlete with 20 ounces sloshing in their stomach. You've probably been in that boat before where you're doing something athletic and you're like, man, it just feels like it's just moving around my stomach all the time. It's not doing anything. It feels freaking terrible. I know myself. And now they're feeling nauseated, right? And then they're going to stop drinking even more, or they're going to have to get pulled out, or they're going to have to take a rest, right? So small, frequent, and moderate drinks. 6 to 8 ounces every 15 to 20 minutes is going to be much better than downing a whole bottle of water at the water break. And that is, you know, obviously a coaching decision of how that works. not an athlete decision when it comes to how water breaks work. So personally, whenever I run groups and stuff here at my gym, basically I segment things up, right? We do our general warm-ups. We'll do our SAQ, speed, agility, quickness, some pogo work, what, you know, all that stuff to get the body prepped and going. We do that. I get a quick drink of water. Then we actually move into our true plyometric work, our throws, that kind of stuff. Then we go right into our sprints. After that, we get another drink. Then we hit our main work that we're doing, whatever that main work might be. We get a drink, and then we do our accessory work, and then get a drink then, and then we're done. So, like, there's several little drinks, but I'm only giving them about a minute or two here and there. Like, it's relatively quick, right? But I want them to be able to have the opportunity to go get a drink here and there and not being able to chug stuff. That way I know that during at least my session, and I also try to make sure that they get a drink before they start, that we've got everything spread out as much as we possibly can. So think about that. Again, when it comes to the hydration side, it's usually not an athlete choice. Sometimes they can ask, but if you're a coach, if you can allow them every 15 to 20 minutes, go just get a quick drink, that's going to beat them doing it every 30 to 45 minutes. Now, that's going to make sure that we keep them hydrated during the practice. Obviously, we want them to do stuff beforehand as well, but if we can do that, that might be able to keep things a little more realistic. All right, the fourth thing I want to talk about is going to be the recovery tags. And glycogen storage requires water, all right? If you don't know basic physiology, anytime you store glycogen, you're also going to store water. So when you store carbohydrate in a muscle, it is stored with water automatically bound to it. So an athlete who finishes a session significantly hypohydrated and then eats a great post-workout meal is trying to build a warhouse with half the bricks at the end of the day. So protein synthesis happens in a cellular environment, and cell volume itself is a signal. So there's a mechanism working here suggesting that cell swelling is anabolic and cell shrinking is catabolic. I want to be really clear about my confidence here in this, is that because this is exactly the kind of claim that gets oversold on the internet, right? That cell volume argument isn't mechanistically well supported. It is not supported by a stack of randomized trials showing that hydrating better builds more muscle, okay? Those trials largely do not exist. So I'm telling you this in a plausible mechanism, not a proven outcome. And if you hear somebody claim that dehydration is why your athlete is not growing, they are probably ahead of the evidence. So what I will say with confidence is this, is if an athlete finishes Monday down 4 pounds and does not replace it and shows up Tuesday still down maybe 1 to 2 pounds, you've not given them one hard session. You've given them a hard session and compromised the next one that's coming up, and you're going to program off the compromised one, right? So chronic mild underhydration does not show up as a dramatic bad day. It shows up basically as their ceiling. And everything is a little bit worse forever, and nobody can pinpoint the reason of why this athlete is having a hard time getting things to progress and move forward. So basically, all this stuff just starts to stack, right? So not only practicing hydrated and coming in hydrated and staying hydrated, but also refilling up and making sure we rehydrate after every session. So the next one we come into, right, we're ready to go and everything's recovered and ready to go on that side. All right. Let's go to the numbers, and I'm going to give you the honest version, which means I'm going to give you evidence that cuts against my own argument as well here. Let's talk about the strength and the power data. So if you only remember one paper or one piece of research from this entire episode, remember this one, because it's the one that speaks directly to our population of our athletes and our clients. So let me walk you through what this means from a coach perspective. There are muscle endurance took the biggest hit in this study, roughly 8%. All right. So think of that like coming down to your accessory work, your tempo sets, your metabolic conditioning, your position specific repeated effort work, right? That is a big chunk of the volume in most programs. Maximal strength in this study took a real but smaller hit, roughly 5.5%. So on a 400-pound squat, that's basically 20 pounds, right? Not catastrophic, but absolutely enough to turn, right, like a planned triple into like potentially maybe a really grindy double, right? It makes me really think about what's going on with the training side. Anaerobic power took a hit of similar aspect from the size and strength. And here's the interesting one for you. On the vertical jump, it was essentially unaffected. So which makes total sense that once you say it out loud, because vertical jump is a body weight dependent task. So you made the athlete a little bit lighter by being dehydrated, and the reduced force production and the reduced mass basically cancel out whenever it comes to testing it. So if your only readiness metric is going to be a counter movement jump, hydration status is one of the things that is structurally blind to. Now, here's what this paper said, was that it was done in 2015 that reported pool effects with hydration, muscle endurance impaired approximately 8.3%, muscle strength approximately 5.5%, and anaerobic power approximately 5.8%. Anaerobic capacity approximately 3.5% and vertical jump approximately 0.9% were not statistically significant. So what they found in this was that dehydration affected all of these things we talked about, right? Some of them were not significantly significant, but the other ones that were, right, we saw pretty big substantial drops in terms of our performance when it came to being dehydrated. Now, the three qualifiers that we need to think about here, and this is going to be the honest part, that the same body of work carries three different things that are important, and coaches who quote the headline numbers without them are misleading people. So the first one is that trained athletes showed smaller decrements than untrained subjects. So our competitive athletes are more robust to this, right, than putting people in a random subject trial and randomized and random people, right? These are obviously more trained people. They're going to be able to handle this better. And that's good news, but it's also a reason to not necessarily go too crazy about it. Number two is in how the dehydration was induced is obviously something that's important on these studies. Active dehydration, meaning fluid loss through actual exercise and heat, produced worse performance than passive dehydration, like fluid restriction or sitting in a sauna, which tells you that in effect that the real world is partly dehydration and partly the accumulated fatigue and the heat strain that came with it. So those are hard to separate when we look at dehydration and looking at performance and the heat. And the third thing, and I think this is a really big one, is that the effect sizes in a lot of these trials that I can find vary enormously between individuals, right? There's published work in which the performance responses to the same hypohydration protocol range from meaningful and worse to meaningfully and better across subjects in the same study, same protocol, and they have the entire opposite results. So you are going to get a wish-wash of things as well. And here's my honest take. The average effect is real and it's worth managing, but the individual effect is unpredictable enough that you should not build a policy on the group average of how you actually approach and talk to your athletes. So you build a policy just on saying we're going to tackle the average. Some people might come in still feeling fine. It's going to make sure that the people that don't do a good job of monitoring their hydration or could potentially see a lot more performance outcomes, hopefully help keep them moving forward in terms of their progress. So everybody's going to respond differently. So it's basically just individualization, but the more trained you are, not only into the heat, but training with less water or being less hydrated, obviously something that your body can somewhat adapt to. We don't want to get in the habit of that, but we can actually see some progress by just giving those athletes more hydration and more sodium and electrolytes, right? So you're going to have somebody here always citing the time trial literatures. So let's go into that in terms of the endurance and hydration side. So the argument is usually going to be something like this. In self-paced real-world endurance events, dehydration up to around 4% body mass does not reliably impair performance, and the 2% threshold came from artificial protocols. Drink to thirst is sufficient. That argument is going to be legitimate. It survived all of the peer review research, and it has been replicated, and I'm not going to pretend that it doesn't otherwise. But here's why it doesn't change our Monday when we walk in the training room. Number one, it's about endurance performance, not strength, not power, or not muscular endurance. The strength literature is going to be a separate body of evidence with different findings, right? There's different mechanisms of how we do things. It's not talking necessarily, we're not doing endurance-based work in our strength conditioning facilities. Number two, it relies on self-pacing as the protective mechanism. And so we know that we usually in the weight room, we're prescribing stuff. We're giving so many sets, so many reps, so much work, right? We are much more prescribed in terms of what we have planned on do for the day. Now, we can obviously pace ourselves and the athletes a little bit, but usually we only have about an hour to train. So we're kind of on time with things with how we move things. Your conditioning intervals are obviously going to be prescribed if you do any kind of conditioning. And the athlete can't pace their way out of that. And if they do, then obviously we call it a lack of effort, and then we're just going to add more work on the back end. That's usually how that works, especially at the collegiate realms. Number three is going to be the self-pacing being protected is not actually a defense of dehydration. It's an admission that the athlete slowed down, and we happen to not notice that they slowed down. And in a race, that's obviously going to cost you placing and your time and all that kind of stuff. In a training block, it's going to cost you the adaptation that we were actually trying to get out of the training block. So both bodies of evidence obviously can be true here. Dehydration is less catastrophic than the 2000s marketing claim that it probably was. And it's meaningfully costing us the exact environment and most that we coach in is we want people giving good quality effort, right? So, I mean, as again, it really kind of depends, but I do think that there's a little bit of wiggle room here. We just want to make sure that if we can get them hydrated, we want them hydrated. And the self-pacing argument just means that they are showing signs that they're clearly tired and run down or whatever, they're feeling it. But in a race, you can easily self-monitor that. It's a little bit harder to do that when you're out on the football field or out on the basketball court or in the strength conditioning room. All right, this one we're going to talk about some myths. And myth number one would be dehydration causes muscle cramps. And this is going to be the one that's going to basically generate people coming after me with hate mail or leaving bad comments. So let's dig into it because I think we can just lead with that one to get it off the plate. The dominant explanation for exercise-associated muscle cramps for the last century has been dehydration and electrolyte depletion. A player cramps. You give them salt and a sports drink, and everything's going to be fine. The evidence for that model is much weaker than you think. So the competing model is called the alternate neuromuscular control hypothesis. Man, that's hard to say. The short version of that is going to be that when a muscle fatigues, you get increased excitatory drive from the muscle spindles and decreased inhibitory drive from the Golgi tendon organs. The alpha motor neurons get overexcited, and the muscle is going to then lock up. So four things that make that model more convincing to me than the electrolyte aspect of it is that, number one, cramps can be induced in the lab in people who are neither dehydrated nor electrolyte depleted. Right? We know we can do that. We can do that with certain exercises. We can. I just know the other day I did an exercise and managed to get my hamstring to cramp with just body weight, right? And I can assure you I wasn't dehydrated. Two, cramps happen also in cold conditions or cool conditions, right? It's not just always in the heat, right? We know that they happen in swimmers and they're in the cool pools. So if it were purely a sweat loss thing, then that should be pretty rare when it comes to the swimming aspect of it. Number three is that prospective studies comparing crampers and non-crampers have generally not found that the hydration or serum electrolyte differences to the old model predicts that it should. And then number four, and this is going to be the most important form for me as a coach, is look what actually stops a cramp. Usually passive stretching almost immediately helps things get better, at least feel better, usually within seconds. Stretching does nothing to our sodium, as we know. What it does do is load the Golgi tendon organ and restore inhibitory drive. The treatment that works is the treatment that the neuromuscular model predicts that should work if we go back to the beginning of this. Now, I do want to be fair that the picture is obviously multifactorial, and there is some evidence that large sweat and sodium losses can increase accessibility in certain individuals, particularly heavy salt sweaters in long, hot events. So think about your linemen in football, but it is not zero. But it is also not the primary driver, and it is not definitely the primary driver in our weight room, especially in the winter months. The coaching implication is very straightforward, in my opinion. If your athletes cramp constantly, the first place to look is not necessarily whether they're getting enough salt and water. It is your conditioning, right? Are they underprepared for the volume and intensity that we happen to be giving them, right? Are we spiking the amount of workload they're getting? Are they cramping in the fourth quarter because they're not fit enough to actually be playing that amount of work to get to the fourth quarter? Okay, cramping is often a training error. And many times we go to blame this on electrolytes. Now, I want to, again, be very clear. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be hydrated. Yes, you should. But there's clearly other mechanisms at play here. And I do think it's very easy to say, well, you didn't drink enough water. You didn't have enough salt. You didn't have enough Gatorade or Powerade. That's why you're cramping. Okay. Chances are there's probably something going on from a training perspective, a preparation perspective, and from a neuromuscular perspective that's happening at the cellular level. And then we actually look in the water and salt and whatever, obviously is not helping our case and increases that to likely happen. All right. Myth number two is the 8 glasses rule or anything that's like that. 8 glasses of water, right? People say you got to have 8 glasses of water by 8 p.m. or drink a gallon a day or half your body weight in ounces. These are not derived from anything, right? They are just ideas that got repeated until they sounded like they were data and people actually latched onto them. So here's the actual problem with them, which is not that number, that any of the numbers are wrong. It's that a fixed number is the wrong way to be able to provide this information. Sweat rates are going to vary across individuals, obviously, by several different factors. They're the same sport, they're in the same training session, the same environment. Two athletes are going to have completely different sweat losses, preparations, and how they feel. So prescribing every athlete the same fluid volume is also like prescribing every athlete the exact same training weight when we walk into the strength and conditioning room, right? It'll be roughly right for a couple of them and wrong for everybody else. So obviously I know that it's an average, but just telling athletes to go drink a gallon of water or drink 8 glasses, right? That's not going to be necessarily the best way to ensure that they are hydrated. It's just not going to work, right? The third myth, that if you're thirsty, it's already too late. And there is some truth to this. And the other half of this is, you know, like the less important piece, right? So there is a little bit of truth here. Thirst does lag behind fluid loss in some degree, okay? That part is true. But thirst is also a genuinely sophisticated regulatory system tied to our body's plasma osmolality and vasopressin, all right? It's not a broken system. And the drink ahead of thirst message, push it to its conclusion, is exactly what happened to kill people from being overly hydrated. So yes, if your body is telling you're thirsty, yes, go get a drink. But if you're trying to constantly drink a bottle of water every half an hour to try to stay ahead of that, then you overhydrate yourself. And that can also have negative consequences as well. So if you're thirsty, then go get a drink. If you know that you have a practice or something physically active that's going to be coming up, your athletes are, make sure that they're getting ample water or electrolytes at least 1 to 2 hours before that. Okay. Again, we don't want to go back to chugging that water or chugging that drink, but basically starting an hour or two out, we should be sipping that Gatorade, Powerade, ideally the zero versions, in my opinion, the water, whatever that is, every 15 to 20 minutes going up into that practice to ensure that we are hydrated and we are prepared. All right. The fourth myth is that you cannot drink too much water. And sorry, but yes, you can drink too much water. And this is the part where I actually stopped being interested and started being serious, because this one has actually killed people as well. So exercise-associated hyponatremia is a dilutional drop in blood sodium, generally defined as below 135 millimoles per liter, occurring during or within 24 hours after exercise. It's the primary cause is overconsumption of hypotonic fluid, typically compounded by non-osmotic stimulation of the hormone vasopressin, which prevents the kidneys from clearing the excess water. The two things I need every coach listening to internalize here and understand, or if you're an athlete to be able to understand: one, sports drink do not protect against this, okay? They are hypotonic. They are more dilute than your blood, so drinking enormous volumes of sports drink can still dilute you. And number two, the early symptoms overlap almost perfectly with heat illness. You're going to have things like headache, nausea, confusion, vomiting, disorientation, and the treatments are going to be the opposite. If you push fluids into an athlete who is hyponatremic because you think it's heat illness, you can obviously make things considerably worse. So I want you to notice something here, that the single intervention that helps you sort out the most dangerous aspect in our field is going to be a bathroom sale, all right? That's going to be the tool that's going to be the most important. So we want to weigh in before, we weigh out after. An athlete who's symptomatic and has lost significant weight is a dehydration, right? Struggling with the heat. An athlete who is symptomatic and has gained weight or held steady despite heavy sweating is in a hyponatremia red flag, okay? They've probably had too much fluids over the course of a practice or even before practice and or after practice. Those people, usually you're going to stop fluids. And then obviously you want to make sure you get the appropriate emergency medical services on the phone or there as soon as possible. your ATs, whatever, immediately get the medical staff clearly involved, right? So I do think that if you can weigh in before, weigh in after, not only from your practice, your lifting sessions and everything else, but that's going to be a much easier way to tell who needs more of these and who does not. Myth number five, the electrolyte packet is a hydration strategy, okay? And I have to do this one because you're probably filled with it on your social media, and I am somebody that's very pro-element. I will be honest on that. But there's an entire category of products right now built on the claim that water alone is not enough and that you're chronically under-replacing sodium, and that packet in every bottle is going to be the fix based on my element. And so let me separate here what's true from what's actually being sold to you from a product perspective. What is true is that sodium drives thirst. Sodium improves fluid retention. And plain water in a large volume suppresses thirst and increases urine output. And there is a real between athlete variability and sweat sodium concentrations. Okay. Some people generally lose a lot more salt than others do. And you can often see it. They have the white crust on their black shirts after practices or games or what have you. What I think is oversold, that this describes sometimes me, sometimes every other athlete that we have to work with on every day, regardless of the session length or environment, right? And it does not. For a 60-minute lift in an air-conditioned facility by an athlete who eats a normal, healthy diet, the marginal value of an electrolyte packet is going to be very close to zero. The typical Western diet is not sodium deficient, as we all know. It's not my opinion. This is the entire basis of every public health campaign that's been trying to get sodium decreased. Where these products earn their money is narrow and real set of conditions. Long sessions, high heat, two-a-days, short turnarounds, always training outside, right? Heavy sweaters, right? Those are going to be people that I think can very benefit from this. Athletes who have to restore a large deficit quickly to be able to prepare. Somebody like a wrestling between weigh-in and a match. In those situations, I do believe sodium is not optional. It's going to be the whole mechanism that's going to help these athletes, and I will defend that these products like element like that very loudly, right? I don't have air conditioning in my strength conditioning facility, or I'm constantly sweating, I'm constantly physically active, you have long training sessions. There are places for these as well. And if you happen to be somebody that eats a lot better of a diet, right, you happen to eat relatively clean foods, you're probably not getting as much sodium because you're not going to have all that Western diet stuff in there. You are somebody that also element or some kind of these sodium packets or electrolyte packets are probably worth it. If you're eating like crap, probably not worth it. But the problem is that the marketing does not distinguish who actually needs these. So the general population client doing a 45-minute training session, trying to buy into a packet like this, right, that they don't have, right? But while we're talking about like a football lineman, again, who actually needs it because they're drinking all these sports drinks and they're constantly outside and running and lifting and practicing whatever, and also the fact that they're 300 pounds, they need more sodium than the average size person, that's a real topic of conversation. But the uncomfortable side of this is I would rather you spend nothing on the electrolytes and spend more time paying attention to the scale before and after your training sessions, because that will actually let you know whether you need the electrolytes or you need the hydration. So obviously, if you're an athlete or your client and you're constantly 2-3% dehydrated after your training sessions, then I do think something like an element pack or electrolyte pack is very well worth it. If that's not you, you're always training in air-conditioned facilities, right? You're just doing a normal standard hour training session, you probably do not need those packets. All right, let's move on to the next aspect here. Everything up to now was so that you can believe and trust what I'm about to tell you at the end here to be able to fix some of these things. So step number one, we've got to figure out what our sweat rate is for our athletes or for yourself. And this is going to be the very basics, very, very basics here. Weigh your athletes in minimal dry clothing immediately before their training session or the practices, if at all possible. You would record that and then have them empty their bladder before that as well. Okay, so they come with their clothes, take their shoes off, hopefully they went to the bathroom, get their body weight. Then we want to track every ounce of fluid they consume during the training session, ideally, right? Either a marked bottle or a shaker cup is going to have it there. And at the end, basically they dry off, whatever, same minimal clothing that they had, and then we weigh them again. The sweat loss equals the starting weight minus the ending weight plus the fluid consumed. Then we divide that by session duration to get an hourly rate. So as an example, because I do think that things are always easy to understand with numbers, an athlete starts at 202 pounds, finishes at 199, they drink 24 ounces during their two-hour practice. So they're 202 pounds, they finish at 199, so they lost 3 pounds. They drank 24 ounces during their two-hour practice. They have 3 pounds lost, is about 48 ounces. Add the 24 that they drank, 72 ounces of sweat over 2 hours. 36 ounces per hour is what that breaks down to. Now, you know something real about that actual person, how much they actually lost. So we can do this in different conditions, obviously. We can do this on a cold day. We can do the hot day, the highest intensity sessions, or you can go as deep as you want. But that's going to be the biggest way to figure out how much they're actually going to need to be able to keep up with their hydration status. Second step is going to be obviously daily monitoring that. So this is what the sports medicine side does and the collegiate strength conditioning side. It's usually abbreviated as WUT, known as weight, urine, and then thirst. So weight, so first thing in the morning, after going to the bathroom, before eating anything, we compare against a rolling baseline of what their weight is. Drop more than about 1% from the baseline, that's obviously a red flag. From the urine side, the color chart on the bathroom wall that you probably see in a lot of college strength conditioning rooms or bathrooms, pale straw is kind of the target, all right? Dark apple juice is obviously a big problem. Completely clear all day is actually its own red flag as well, especially an athlete chasing the gallon of water, trying to drink in a bunch of water. The T for thirst is that are they thirsty right now before they have started any kind of physical activity or done anything? One flag, you want to monitor it, right? If one thing's off, you monitor them. Two issues, we got to intervene. We got to do something to be able to help this athlete right now. If all three of those are flagged up and issues, they do not need to be training in high heat, right? High volume or high risky training sessions or practices, right? That's going to be a decision that we make to be able to do that, right? You will not get compliance on all three from the whole team, right? If you're working with teams, that's not going to happen, right? We try to get their weight the best we can. Weight is going to be the highest signal of what's going on for them. It's the easiest thing, especially if you talk about like football, you see it done all the time. It's one of the easier ones to get. And it's also going to protect us on the hyponatremia side. And if you only do one thing for this entire episode, put a scale in your weight room so people can actually get on it and measure their weight. We've got one in our hallway area. I'm not sure how much the athletes actually use it that much, but we always have one at least available, I think, in the college and the high school strength conditioning aspect, something you definitely want to do and try to stay on top of. All right. Step number three is then going to be the before aspect. So the general sports medicine guidance for pre-exercise fluid is going to be in the range of 5 to 7 milliliters per kilogram of body weight. So roughly doing it 4 hours before your training session or exercise with additional fluid if urine is still dark or no urine has been produced before. So for a 90-kilogram athlete, that's roughly 450 to 600 milliliters of water. So we call it 15 to 20 ounces, 4 hours. Okay. That's not chugging. That's just a normal amount of liquid with a normal actual meal that you would have. The practical version for us coaches, who's obviously not going to do the math on every single athlete that we have, the day before is more important than the hour before. All right. You cannot fix a bad day before with a big bottle at 3:55 in the afternoon before your 4 o'clock training session. All right. All you do is need to make them go to the bathroom and they got that water slugging around there. So emphasize hydration the day before big practices, big games, whatever. Make sure they understand that. Step number four is then going to be during the actual sessions. The goal is not zero fluid loss. The goal is to keep the losses from becoming incredibly large. From a practicality standpoint, keep it about 2% of their body mass or less in a prescribed intensity setting, right? If it's got a hard training session, and do not go the other direction and try to get them to gain weight or be over. So for most strength and conditioning training sessions that are going to be 90 minutes or less in a controlled environment, not my room, obviously, water is going to be genuinely fine. It's all that most people are going to need. So I'm not going to sell you any kind of electrolyte pack here for your 45 to 60 minute lift in your nice cool gym. Not going to be needed. It's probably not going to be a hydration problem, especially if they've done the hydration stuff early at the beginning. Sodium actually starts to become important when you hit some combination of sessions beyond about 90 minutes. So you got really long, maybe like 2 hour practice, significantly high heat, high sweat rate athletes, and visible salt crusting on skin and the clothing, or multiple sessions in the given day when you actually have to restore things between the bouts. And the reason sodium is important is not just the replacement. The sodium drives thirst and it drives fluid retention. Those are the two big things. It's going to drive more thirst. It's going to drive more fluid retention. Plain water in large volume actually suppresses our thirst and increases urine output, so the athlete stops drinking and pees out what they did drink. So sodium keeps them drinking and keeps the fluid within their body. That's going to be important, especially when we're talking about training longer than 2 hours, outside, high heat, multiple sessions in a day. That's going to be important. If you just have one strength and conditioning session a day and that's all that you're doing, 60 minutes, water is going to be more than fine. Step five, afterwards, so when you're all done, post-session is where we can actually try to make some good progress, and it's where most programs usually do the worst when it comes to the hydration side. The general guidance for aggressive rehydration when there's a short turnaround is replaced roughly 1.5 times the fluid deficit because you will urinate out some of what you take in. So 3 pounds lost, about 48 ounces of deficit, target something like 72 ounces over the following hours, ideally with sodium. And here's an important caveat that aggressive replacement guidance is for short turnarounds. All right. Talking about 2-a-days, tournaments, multiple big practices, or maybe you've got, you know, like an actual game with like 2 halves, like football. Weigh in to the competition windows. If your athlete has 24 hours before they train again, normal eating and drinking with adequate sodium will handle it, and you do not need a specific protocol. And I do want to flag something that is nutritionally obvious and constantly forgotten, that food rehydrates people. A real meal with salt in it, obviously, plus fluid, is going to outperform just drinking fluid alone. So your athletes do not need a specific powder. Most of them just need a good quality dinner after the training sessions with their water, and they're going to be just fine in more cases than not. Step six is going to be how to implement this with an actual team or group of people. So everything I just described sounds great when you've got just a few athletes and a small group. So let's talk about large groups, what you can do. So one, like I said, have a scale available, always put it in the door, outside an office, something like that. Something where there's a lot of traffic, so it's harder for them to walk past and not be able to step on it. Number two, whiteboard or a list with names and a baseline weight. So athletes write down their own number, right? You're not doing the data entry. They are. Just put the grid sheet right next to it or on the wall next to it. That's probably the best way to go about it. Number three, everybody should have their own water bottles. If you're in group settings, ideally they have their name on it. And ideally it's marked every like 4 ounces or so on the bottle to be able to track how much water they're actually drinking. If you're sharing coolers and cups and whatever, it's a lot harder to track what's going on there. Step number four, do your sweat rate test for your highest risk athletes first, usually your big boys. You don't have to do it with everybody. So your linemen, your wrestlers, anybody that's in a helmet and pads, anybody who's ever cramped, been treated for heat illness, or has told you that they don't really drink a whole lot of water, or they don't like to drink water during practice. Those are the people that you're going to kind of keep an eye on. Number five, build it into an existing routine rather than making this all brand new. Right? Obviously, you don't have one, then it is going to be new. But if you have any kind of routine, take some of these pieces and implement it easier. The weigh-in is going to be the easiest one if you're not doing it already. Not doing a separate meeting or a separate app, right? Usually, we're going to find that we can get stuff done early, especially if we can get our athletes in there early. If everything starts at 6 a.m., get them in there at 5:45, 5:50, get them all weighted and done, get that over with. Number six is going to be kind of an obvious one, but teach athletes why this is important in 90 seconds or less. Athletes comply with things they understand and things they're told. So if we can show them how it's going to decrease their speed, decrease reaction time, decrease the amount of weight they're able to lift in the strength and conditioning room, how that's going to actually affect them, that's probably going to get you better compliance. Compared into winning games or having good quality practices, right? Those are all things that athletes understand a lot more of, rather than just saying, hey, you need to drink water. Saying, hey, if you're dehydrated, you're probably going to squat 10, 20, 30 pounds less today, right? We need you to drink water. Or, you know, if you want to be able to be quicker and more reactive on the field, you got to be able to stay hydrated. Make sure you're getting enough water before you come into practice. All right. And the substances for me that keep coming up here that I want to talk about, three quick ones, because they come up usually common questions that I get with parents and young athletes that I work with. Number one's going to be caffeine. The idea that coffee dehydrates you is largely overstated, in my opinion, as I have coffee here next to me. In habitual users, moderate caffeine intake does not produce a meaningful net fluid deficit, and caffeinated beverages count towards your daily fluid. So where it does matter is a high dose pre-workout in a non-habitual user before going out like a hot training session. That is a different scenario than an athlete who drinks two cups of coffee every morning, and that's just part of their normal life, somebody like me. Number two, don't have a whole lot to talk about this, but it is a real concern with college athletes, is alcohol. And this one is not overstated. Alcohol genuinely suppresses vasopressin and increases urine output. So it is a real diuretic. And the relevant coaching context is not the athlete who drinks during the session. It's going to be the athlete who is out late, obviously, on the Saturday night, shows up to Sunday for a conditioning or training session in August, right? That athlete is starting in a huge hole and is going to feel like absolute shit. And usually you don't know it. Maybe you'll see it on some athletes, but sometimes you have some kids, if you don't know how much they have, they actually hide it pretty well. So if we coach college athletes and you're not accounting for this, we're obviously missing a genuine, recurring, predictable risk that's going to happen. I think most college coaches that I know understand this, but it is obviously a real conversation worth having. Then another one is going to be creatine, right? Creatine increases intracellular water, which is why people gain a couple pounds usually in the first couple of weeks of when they start taking creatine. So there's two implications here. One, it will contaminate your body weight and baseline. So obviously it's going to inflate that. So if an athlete starts creatine and you reset their baseline rather than reading that as them gaining weight, as improved hydration. Okay. Number two, the old claim that creatine causes cramping or heat illness has not held up on any studies, nothing that I've been able to find. If anything, the evidence actually probably leans the other way, but I would still hold in line for the supplement conversation with your kids or athletes, talk to medical staff, whatever. Not something you want to go too crazy in terms of the physiology side, but chances are if your athlete's taking creatine, it's going to be okay. Again, just make sure they're staying hydrated. It's going to make things go a lot better because obviously there are some positive benefits to taking creatine for athletic performance. All right. So here are some common questions that you could potentially get or questions that I get from parents and athletes that I probably have answered over the, 15 plus years of working with people. Some people are going to say, my athletes drink all day. They carry those big jugs everywhere. Great, right? Carrying is not necessarily going to be that they're drinking it all the time. And a gallon jug that's just going to be 3/4 full by the afternoon is not going to be that great of an idea, right? It's not a hydration strategy. Ideally, we want to measure it. So if they're going to do that, make sure they're drinking half of it by lunch or 1 or 2 o'clock or whatever, right? You're actually giving it something to shoot for. Another objection usually is, but I coach indoors in a cold gym. Sweat rates are lower. They're not zero, and cold environments are obviously going to blunt thirst. So some of the largest deficits that I've seen personally usually were in cold weather sports because nobody thinks to drink when they're not hot, right? It's not as common to be able to do that. Another one you're going to hear is, but my athletes are adults, and it's not my job to manage their fluid intake. Well, it is not our job to make them drink, but it is our job to know that we are actually giving them the information and telling them what to do and trying to be able to, one, have the benefit from performance, but also be able to see how things go. Another one that I have also heard, the weigh-ins are triggering for some athletes. I don't want scales in my gym, or I don't want to weigh them, especially when we're talking about the female athletes. And this is a legitimate concern, and I'm not going to say that it's not something you shouldn't have to consider. You obviously have options, right? But weigh-in numbers can be private if you really want them to. You can be recorded by a coach rather than posted on like the sheet of paper that I talked about. You can measure the change rather than the absolute value, which is the number that you'd actually need. And with a population where disordered eating is an actual concern, then you defer to your medical or nutrition staff if you have one. Obviously, I do not have one, but if you do, that's something that you talk to them about. And doing the intervention badly with a vulnerable athlete is worse than not doing it at all. So, I think if you can have those conversations and be honest with it or no, then you can kind of put that to the medical staff as needed. But I do know that is an issue. I know with wrestlers, I've never personally had much of an issue whenever I was been around wrestling, but that obviously is another population where it can be an issue. All right, another one is, but this is one more thing of a list of a billion things they've already got to do as a coach. And yes, I will agree. Yeah, it is adding something. And it, in my opinion, it is one of the cheapest things that you can do that's actually going to help your performance and people keep track of things. So if your athlete monitoring is uncontrolled hydration status, some percentage of your data is going to be uncalled for, and then you don't know what's really actually going on. It's makes it a little bit harder. I think in the college rooms, it's much easier to do this. Obviously, in the private setting, that's entirely up to you. I personally do not weigh my athletes every single training session, but we do make sure that because we don't have AC, or at least not full AC, that they've always got bottles of water with them. And if they say, oh, I forgot my bottle of water, we always tell them to go get one, right? We want to try to stay on top of that as much as we can. It's really not that hard. But if you are obviously and wanting to do this, spend the $30 and go get a bathroom scale, right? If you also want to do something, you can print a urine chart and put it in your bathroom. That's probably something I should actually do in my facility with how many kids I work with. Make sure they've got plenty of bottles of water. If you're going to track the weights, you've got that written down somewhere, right? Something like that. All right, one of the other final things I want to talk about here is special population. Now, kids are not small adults with thermal aspect, all right? They have a higher surface area to mass ratio, right? They are often less efficient sweaters, and they are worse at recognizing and acting on their thirst. They also have less autonomy usually as kids. 14-year-old cannot leave the field to go get water, usually without asking, right? Usually you got to ask to be able to do stuff. So from a practical side, as I talked about earlier, scheduled fluid breaks, not permissioned ones, right? Have them every 15 to 20 minutes. Flavored fluid meaningfully increases voluntary intake in kids, and that is just a legitimate tool. It's not a compromise. We know that's the case. That's why we choose to sell zero-calorie flavored stuff here. We do know that it gets kids to usually drink more fluid than they probably would if they didn't. And be aware that in the youth and high school setting, that hyponatremia risk from well-meaning adults screaming drink more water is not actually theoretical. It does actually happen. We just want to make sure that our parents and coaches understand that, hey, they do need to drink plenty of water, but we also don't want them chugging bottles of water before they go out to practice. All right, another special population that I want to talk about here is weight class and physique athletes. This population deliberately dehydrates, okay, been there. Wrestling, combat sports, powerlifting, bodybuilding, well done. I'm not going to pretend that acute water manipulation does not happen, because it does. It's somebody that did it at a very aggressive rate at every level. And pretending otherwise just means the athletes does it without supervision. So what I will say is this. The performance decrement is real, and it is dose dependent. And the rehydration window is very, very important. So a two-hour weigh-in to competition window does not allow meaningful recovery from a large deficit. A 24-hour window largely does, like in, like, say, powerlifting or whatever. So if you coach a sport with a same-day weigh-in, it's going to be a lot more complex and completely different from a sport with a sport with weigh-ins the day before. Excuse me. Coaches routinely apply the wrong one. So the best thing I can say is, if you've got athletes trying to cut a bunch of weight with a two-hour weigh-in, you should try to deter them right from that. I know wrestling is going to happen. Make sure they understand the importance of getting hydrated, getting salt in immediately after. Think about it like those bouts. That's going to be important. We also want to make sure they're not doing insane weight cuts. Anything more than 5% in less than 2 hours, for me, is a strict no-go. I think anything it should be 1% to 3%. That should be about it. 24 hours, you can start talking about 5% to 7%. You never want to go in that 10% range. I think that gets a little bit too aggressive. I have been there lots of times. I can tell you how it feels. It is not fun. So those are things worth considering there on the physique athlete side. I'm not going to go into the bodybuilding side. That's not my space. There's people that know how to do that well. If you have questions about those, just let me know. I'll be more than happy to answer those for you. All right, talking about master's athletes in particular, thirst sensation is blunted with age. Now, kidney concentrating ability also declines as well in these populations. And this population is far more likely to be on medications that also affect their fluid balance, particularly diuretics for blood pressure. So from a practical side, scheduled intake rather than thirst-driven intake is more defensible for these groups than any other, in this population where you actually want to know what medications they are on before you start programming really hard conditioning sessions outside, things like that, right? This is a true issue. I will say that more than likely, if you have an older population client, you can probably be okay if they're coming to you and they have been physically active, but obviously everybody is a little bit different. But just understand that those are real concerns that we have with those athletes. The big one's going to be that their thirst is blunted more at their age, and their kidney concentrating ability is also going to decline. All right, let's wrap this all up here. Pull this thing in here before I let you go. Here is this entire episode here in a couple sentences. Number one, the dehydration effect is real, but it is smaller than the marketing era claimed and larger than the backlash that gets implied. And the size depends almost entirely on whether the athlete gets to choose their own intensity. Chances are, if you're working in a strength and conditioning facility, they do not get to choose their own intensity that much, right? You're probably running a room, doing things, keeping them active. Number two, the mechanisms are cardiovascular, thermoregulatory, central nervous system, and recovery. And only the first two usually get talked about, right? Usually talking about the cardiovascular, thermoregulatory side, right? We want to make sure that we understand that athletes know that it is going to affect their central nervous system, the recovery. It is going to affect all that stuff. So if we talk about that, they can hopefully get more buy-in. Number three, individual variation is enormous, which means the group average is a bad basis for policy, and measurement is the only real answer to know for each individual person. It is going to take a little bit of work if you work with groups, but if you can get individual numbers for each person, that's obviously going to be able to help you tell a little bit more about hydration. Number four, cramping is mostly a fatigue and preparedness problem, not an electrolyte problem. Yes, there are electrolyte issues that are out there, but chances are something is happening from a lengthening perspective, a tissue preparation perspective, a training perspective. Those should be looked at just as importantly as we say drink more water and take more salt. Although, if I had to make a bias, chances are very athletes that train very hard probably do need a little bit more sodium. Number five, overdrinking is a version of this that actually can truly kill people outside of just the obviously underhydrating as well. And keeping a scale to be able to track people's weight is going to be your best way to pay attention from both directions. But the big thing I want you to understand is that overhydrating your athletes can be just as much of an issue as them being underhydrated. So we want to make sure we have that discussion of what that looks like as well. Number six, the entire intervention usually is going to be monitoring your weight with a scale. All right. That's really all that's going to be it. And if you can get your athletes to understand that, then it's much easier for them to be able to stay on track of it, especially if you're talking about in the large group setting. Now, I want to bring this all back here, wrap things up here real quick. But the uncomfortable truth is that the return on the investment here is usually embarrassing when it talks about just tracking the weight, right? That's usually the issue that we have, that it's not embarrassing because it's small and it's embarrassing because it doesn't take anything but other than monitoring your weight before and after your training sessions. It's really not that hard to do. You just have to do it. You got to think about like brushing your teeth, right? You do it in the morning, you do it in the evening. But that's going to be the best way for you to stay, best way for you to stay on top of it and keep it tracked for each individual athlete, right? You're not going to find another 5% of performance improvement with a small tweak like you will with monitoring your hydration. Right, you're not going to find it in new periodization models or anything like that. You're going to find it when athletes show up, take their hydration seriously, and you're going to really find that your athletes feel and perform better. And if you can get them on board with staying hydrated, being hydrated, understanding, yes, they can have some electrolytes if they need them, especially if they're outside, they're doing a lot of work, they're bigger athletes, then that becomes a real conversation, right? Those are all things that are going to help improve your athletes' preparedness and make it much easier for you to just do your job on the strength and conditioning side. So if you didn't take away anything from this episode other than, hey, we need to monitor their weight, I hope that's one thing that you can start implementing right away. Now, obviously, you should have learned a little bit about how the body works and how we actually sweat and lose weight and how the electrolytes work and why just being hot isn't the only thing that's going to decrease your performance, but how that all works. I hope it's all things that we can actually take away and be useful. So if you did happen to find this episode useful, do me one favor, send it to somebody that wants to know more about hydration or has been telling athletes to drink a lot of water or doesn't need salt, anything like that, share it with one person. I really appreciate it. And that's not only is how the show grows here, but it's how we help improve athletes and coaches when it comes to making general recommendations to their athletes and their clients. And if you want, you should be able to just go on to Google for the sweat rate calculator. You should be able to find one of those. You can probably even find an app, honestly. But if you go to Google and just type in sweat rate calculator, you'll find one right there that you can use if you want to be able to actually calculate your sweat rate for each individual athlete or for yourself. Now, if you want more things from me, what you can do is follow me over on Instagram at bsmitley. You can also check out everything that I offer over on thirstgym.com. That's going to be where I put all the article forms of everything. And of course, if you want to jump on my newsletter, that's going to be down in the description box below and in the show notes as well. And then the one final thing here before I let you go, I also recently opened a new school community called the Thirst Coaching Lab. It's designed for coaches, athletes, personal trainers, physical therapists. If you're looking to learn more about actually how to write strength and conditioning training programs or get your own training programs looked at and audited specifically by me, we're going to be doing these every other week, at Thursday at noon. That's where they'll be live. Obviously, if you drop your program, I do it. You'll still get the recordings as well. But basically, every other week, I'm going to be going over training programs, breaking them down, sets, reps, volume, talking about what kind of model it is, general recommendation on rest, right? Basically, it's to be able to help you level up your training program. It's essentially a mentorship at a very affordable rate. There's only 25 initial spots at $29 a piece. So if you want in, I would get in now. I'll make sure I link that school community also in the show notes and in the description box below as well in this video so that you can get access to it. Our first call is going to be Thursday, July 23rd, I think it is, at noon. And they said, if you can't make it, that's okay because the recording will be in there as well. There's also going to be a bunch of other freebies in there as well. I'm going to put in some prompts and general questions 1 to 2 times a week just to have a general discussion. I'm going to try to put as much educational content in there as I can as well. Stuff that's already free, but I'm also going to put stuff in there that's going to be exclusive to just that group as well. Talking about sets and reps and things like that. It's going to have a lot of stuff. It's just going to take me time to get them all in there. But the big thing I want you to take away right now is the mentorship aspect of how to write better training programs. My goal with it is for if you join that group, you will be able to write better training programs than 98% of the people other strength coaches and personal trainers out there right now. So you'll be able to get a lot of immediate feedback. So I would check that out if you're interested in your coach listening. Could be something that's very, very beneficial for you. And I'm going to try to, when I get courses in there, I'm going to try to get them approved by NSCA so that you can actually get CEUs from them as well if you happen to take them. So something I'm going to try to work on. It's going to take me a little bit of time, but that is the goal with it. But I'm going to wrap up today's video. Ramble long enough. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in for the Thirst for More podcast, and I'll see you at the next episode. Thanks for listening to Thirst for More podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley. Or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.